The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And, of course, today we'll dig a little bit deeper into the main theme of the June issue of Our State Magazine, which is all about North Carolina lighthouses. The first story up is Under the Spindle's Eye. Since Currituck Beach Lighthouse was completed in 1875, it stood witness as the community of Corolla grew up around it, keeping faithful watch over sound and sea. We climbed slowly the tower's 220 steps not long before sunset, surrounded all the way up by its 650,000 bricks laid in 1-3 common bond, led by 19-year veteran Currituck Beach Lighthouse site manager Megan Agresto. "You can touch anything metal, but nothing glass," she said as she installed my wife Ann and me inside of the hollow first-order Fresnel lens at the 162-foot pinnacle. The lens was made in France and tested first in Parisian tunnels, shipped to New York, and reassembled and tested again on Staten Island, then shipped down the East Coast. It was brought into Currituck Sound by way of the Albemarle and Chesapeake Canal. All the glass and brass parts that, when assembled, would make up this polygon measuring 6 feet in diameter and standing just shy of 10 feet tall. Megan seated us on the little green steps, surrounded by the lens's small prismatic arcs that make up its whole circumference, warning us gently that we might become dizzy, as many do, from all the refracting and reflecting prisms around us. Yet I sense that some might feel even more a sense of wonder, almost hypnotized. We were still inside of this tower's great eye at the very moment, 5 minutes after sundown, when its light suddenly came on. A small source no larger than a stack of half-dozen quarters, yet projecting its vision and casting its brightness 18 nautical miles seaward, while allowing some of its surplus out soundward from the lower western portion of the lens. So there we were, with 50,000 candle power, that's a whole lot of candles, not two feet away from our heads. Mariners way out on the deep blue sea, duck hunters in skiffs and blinds on the sounds, travelers on the Wright Memorial Bridge, where the waters of Currituck flow into those of the Albemarle, and closer from the sound waters between Pine Island and the Narrows Island Club, many people of an evening and a night can see this light emanating from the last brick lighthouse to be put up on the Carolina coast. And the spindle's eye of Currituck Beach Lighthouse, looking out over hundreds of square miles, can also see them. Currituck Beach Lighthouse's inaugural lighting came on the first day of December, 1875, at once filling a long-feared dark spot halfway between Cape Henry Lighthouse in Virginia and Body Island Lighthouse in the plains of marsh above Oregon Inlet. For just shy of a century and a half since, the light has had an 18-mile unimpeded view of the ocean and its never-settled world. The bark Nuovo Ottavia, a small Italian sailing ship wrecked on March 1, 1876, 3 months to the day after Currituck Beach Lighthouse first shined, straight out on a sea beach before the lighthouse, pushed in by a southeast wind. U.S. life-saving station Jones Hill, just north of the light, responded at once, according to Outer Banks historian James Charlet, launching in heavy surf. But soon oars, then the surfboard, then bodies came floating back in, and all of the surfmen of Jones Hill were lost. The bark itself was splintered by the next afternoon, simply vanishing. One big piece of her stern turned up at Kitty Hawk. Only 4 Italian mariners from the doomed ship survived, and they told of how the Jones Hill Station surfboat came up under the ship's bow and was swamped. Well worth noting, though not their charge, Currituck Beach Lighthouse's superintendent of construction, its clerk, and 20 other men still working on the new structure also rushed out onto the beach to help with the rescue efforts. So it began, not the role of untold thousands of ships that the light has steered away from the Carolina shoals and saved, but rather those few it could not, dozens coming in along its range, 18 miles to the north and 18 miles to its south in its first 50 years or so. 1 month to the day after Nuova Otavia wreck, the schooner Henry G. Fay wrecked 3 miles south of Currituck Beach Lighthouse, the ship and cargo of logs a total loss. Many of the ships lost in this range of space and time were schooners, though Nuova Otavia was hardly the only one of her kind. The bark Harkaway wrecked out there in 1885, bark Vibiblia in 1891, and bark Oriente in 1907. A pair of barges also fell to the unpitying sea. The N. Boynton in 1889 and the William H. Macy in 1915. Yet before World War I, only one steamer, and Metropolis was her name. A Union blockader during the Civil War, by 1878 she was an enlarged, poorly kept merchant ship, and when she came in on January 31st, she was wallowing in heavy seas, her cargo of long steel rails for a Brazilian railroad shifting hideously below decks. The captain steered toward land, grounding her on the outer bar 3 miles below the light, at a loss of vessel, freight, and 85 lives. Metropolis's wreck came hard upon the deaths of 98 sailors in the wreck of the USS Huron at Nag's Head only a couple of months earlier, and made a compelling case to the federal government. Having already built the Currituck Beach Lighthouse, Congress now acted to place more U.S. life-saving stations along the Carolina coast to shorten the distances between them, from 10 to 15 miles apart to about half of that, and to lengthen their seasons of operation. Yet we must remember, on most nights of the Currituck Beach Lighthouse's first half century, as ever since, ships have floated freely miles out into the ocean's horizon because the light tendered them its beam and saw them safely by. Though the full power of this light has always aimed seaward and on the soundward side, its glow has seen the late fall arrival of ducks and geese by the thousandfold, so thick that they darken the Currituck Sound skies, giving the county, the banks, and even the lights their name. Currituck, from the Algonquin Indian word, Currutank, where the wild geese fly. The light was under construction when the epic East Coast paddler Nathaniel Bishop floated down Currituck Sound in late 1874, noting in his classic book, Voyage of the Paper Canoe, clouds of ducks and some Canada geese, as well as brant, kept up a continuous flutter as they rose from the surface of the water. Naturalist H. H. Brimley wrote in the Old Times on Currituck of estimating a line of flocks of Canada geese in the 1880s at well above the 10,000 mark. When federal law closed down market hunting in 1918, the light watched over the sporting side of things. The Currituck Shooting Club, Pine Island Club, and Monkey Island Club, just a few marsh islands away, had been around for years. The magazine mogul Joseph Palmer Knapp invested in 7,000 marshy acres at McKay Island in 1918, building a hunting lodge reminiscent of Mount Vernon. Here he envisioned increasing North American waterfowl stocks by breeding them, his more game birds in America growing into one of the most successful wildlife conservation groups ever, Ducks Unlimited. The eye of the great green light saw that all, too, including the coming of the palatial 21,000-square-foot Art Nouveau Corolla Island Hunting Club, later the Whalehead Club, built in the early 1920s but by Marie and Edward Knight, Jr., almost right at the watchtower's feet. Poet James Say once came to see Whalehead in the light. We slipped along over Currituck Sound at dusk in his 13-foot Boston Whaler from Water Lily to Monkey Island to spend a few days there in June of 1984, courtesy of the Nature Conservancy. Whalehead proved to be a ruin, largely abandoned, having faced the elements for 25 years. We slowly walked through this Currituck castle, touching the worn key on its wreck of a Steinway Grand, which still had enough action to make haunting sounds like something out of the horror film Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. Considering the state that the old pile was in back then, its modern restoration is actually breathtaking. We strode on, laying our hands upon the rusty red bricks of Currituck Beach House, and all we could do, so locked up tight was the spindle and so overgrown were its grounds. Over on the sea beach, we let the Atlantic and the light take stock of us, and then, through curtains of rain, we boated back to Monkey Island. That evening, the lighthouse eyed us, as we recalled all the hunters who'd once been out there, returning to camp from the marsh blinds, freezing yet exhilarated beyond belief, my young father among them. Perhaps Jim and I spoke that evening of how jealously the marsh guards of those old hunt clubs protected their territories. One of those marsh guards, the Pine Island Club's St. Clair Leework, was arrested and tried for shooting over the waters of Ark Cove and mortally wounding a young goose-hunting mainlander, Durwood Gallup, with a shot through the side of Gallup's boat just after sunset on Thanksgiving Day, 1920. Though Gallup swore on his deathbed that Leework had shot him, a Currituck jury in the spring of 1921, upon hearing Leework's testimony with an alibi he was nowhere near the scene, acquitted Leework. How could the lighthouse not have seen what really transpired that tragic Thanksgiving dusk? Even the light's great vision had its limits, and the moment might have simply fallen outside its soundward shine. The real truth behind this Where the Wild Geese Fly mystery from more than a century ago may have gotten lost in the shadows, in an umbral darkness in its own time. The sea has forever had its unfathomable rhythms and turns, of course, its eternal secrets, yet sometimes that which has been long obscured may be revealed again. In early 2022, out on Currituck Beach, 3 miles south of Kerala, the light again saw a section of decking, possibly from Metropolis, unsanded by Northeaster and graciously awaiting a handful of maritime archaeologists from East Carolina University to measure and speculate over. Was this really Metropolis? A piece of her back under the spindle's eye after who know how long? ECU researcher Matthew Pawelski judged it likely, though not conclusively so. If the lighthouse knew and could tell, it didn't speak. And in the balance between seeing yet and not telling, hung both straight-up fact and incalculable mystery. We cannot help but admire this tower, though. Far be it from us mere mortals to believe we can divine all that the silent spindle has taken in during its time here, baked by the sun, sandblasted by the winds, touched by sea spray, mists and driving rains, by mild breezes and hurricane torrents alike, and the endless Milky Way on fair nights vaulting above it all. The light is a marker, a monument, a cautionary tale. In a capricious world, it is abiding, steady, impartial, and clear, set in place with great faith, like the bright, shining, all-seeing eye atop the pyramid on our dollar's reverse side. Annui Septis, Providence favors our undertakings. Nothing is negative, destructive, or martial about this solid spire. Its purpose is entirely altruistic, positive, a creation of admonition and hope through all the seasons. May Providence have mercy on the mariner, upon all who see and must believe in this light. May those at the offshore helms it trust it and be guided by the captain's sight of it. May the very sight of the spindle's 3-second flash out of 20 help warn and steer all the coastwise ships as they go sailing up and down our long strand of sandy beaches to their home ports and harbors, and may our gratitude and respect be with all those who built and all who have maintained to this day the bright, ever-watchful eyes of Currituck Beach Lighthouse. And to learn more about the Currituck Beach Lighthouse, go to OBC, that's Oscar Bravo Charlie Inc. .org/Currituck-Beach-Lighthouse. So obcinc.org/Currituck-beach-lighthouse. Turning to the hidden history section of the magazine, which is uncovering forgotten artifacts and delving into dusty archives to explore the little-known stories of our state. This one is called Razzle Dazzled, a camouflage paint scheme designed to evade enemy attacks during World War II, is now a star attraction for the battleship North Carolina. And we have a picture here of the battleship. The exterior of the USS North Carolina sports a paint scheme known as Dazzle Camouflage, specifically a design that it first wore as an active warship in 1943. And it's an odd sort of design. It looks like it's triangular in shape. Some of the shapes of the paint portions are triangular in some fashion, some parallelogram. So there's different colors. There's almost a taupe color, and then a gray color with some green and gray-green color, and then a dark charcoal gray, and then it begins to repeat in a pattern down the side. Hopefully we'll learn more about that in the article. Standing on the main deck of the battleship North Carolina in Wilmington, it's impossible not to be awed by the offensive power of the vessel's nine enormous 16-inch guns, capable of firing shells that weigh almost a ton. But what about the ship's first line of defense? It would have to be equally intimidating, yes? Forget about the other guns bristling from stations around the deck. Imagine instead a menacing crew of deckhands wielding, wait for it, paintbrushes. When a flotilla of tugboats nudged the 729-foot-long, 35,000-ton USS North Carolina through a 90-degree turn on the Cape Fear River and into the ship's permanent slip on October 2, 1961, it wore a peacetime livery of ho-hum haze gray. That's the same color used in a scale replica of the North Carolina that model builder Jim Gower and several others recently spent about a year restoring. Gower, a founding member of the New Bern Maritime Modelers Guild, has a long relationship with the North Carolina. As a schoolboy in Raleigh, he donated nickels and dimes to the SOS, or Save Our Ship, campaign that bought the decommissioned battleship to our state. I was down in Wilmington when the big boy came in, remembers Gower, who skipped school and drove in with friends to see its arrival on that chilly and wet autumn morning. But by 1995, just in time for an event celebrating the 50th anniversary of VJ Day, a surprise awaited visitors. The ship had been repainted in an astonishing camouflage paint scheme commonly known as Dazzle. The new look harkened back to more than 40 years earlier when the North Carolina was earning its stripes in the Pacific. Throughout World War II, the battleship was painted in a total of five different camouflages, designed meant not to conceal, but to deceive. The idea first originated in World War I. By 1917, the British Navy was at the mercy of German U-boats, losing multiple vessels a day. Enter Norman Wilkinson, a sailor in the Volunteer Reserve who also happened to be an artist. He recognized the futility of trying to hide a large vessel with camouflage. But what if you could paint it in a way that made it harder for the submariner launching torpedoes to figure out your range, speed, and direction? The British Admiralty named his invention Dazzle Camouflage. The different paint schemes cut up the ship's silhouette, said Jeff Bokert, East Region Supervisor for the Division of State Historic Sites and former Associate Curator for the Battleship North Carolina. It made it harder for the submarine to get a fix on the ship and fire at it. During World War II, the U.S. Navy expanded upon the concept, coming up with its own design variations. The most radical Razzle Dazzle, applied to the U.S. North Carolina, called Measure 32, was added in 1943 while it was berthed at Pearl Harbor. Suddenly, the port and starboard sides of the battleship and other fighting ships across the fleet were transformed from blank canvases into cubist paintings that would make Picasso proud. The strong angular lines and vivid contrasting colors of navy blue, deck blue, haze gray, pale gray, and black were striking, and if the mighty North Carolina was in any indication, effective. It rode out the war without further battle damage, testifying to the power of the paintbrush. Why was the battleship repainted in Measure 32 in 1995? The reason has been lost to time, but Gower wholeheartedly agrees with the decision. She's really showing off, he says. You don't just see a lot of camouflage on other historic ships. He's right. Across the country, a fleet of World War ships still serve, either on a permanent display or in museums or as museums, but only a handful wear razzle-dazzle camouflage. I can only think of four other ships that have similar periods of interpretation and camouflage themes, says Ryan Szymanski, executive director of the Historic Naval Ships Association. Of course, according to Szymanski, the USS Slater, a destroyer escort based in New York, is the only one of the three painted in Measure 32. And since the scheme varies based on the class of ship, the North Carolina's paint job is just what you'd expect for a battleship of such stature, one of a kind. These days, Gower is toying with the idea of teaming up with a fellow builder to construct his first model of the North Carolina at its jazziest. His only hesitation is the headache he knows is waiting when it comes to painting a 1 in 350 scale ship in Measure 32's dizzying variety of geometric patterns. You're talking about a very precise and tedious job that takes a lot of patience and several glasses of wine to get it right, says Gower with a laugh. Of course, keeping the paint scheme ship-shape on the real thing is no small task either. I joke with our painter that he's got the best job security in the world, says Chris Vargo, assistant director of the battleship North Carolina. While it was completely repainted by a contractor in 2009, the ship relies on a full-time staff painter who focuses almost exclusively on the maintenance of its razzle-dazzle camouflage. That job requires hundreds of gallons of paint, year in and year out. It also requires constant vigilance. The only thing standing between 99 million pounds of steel and the environment is paint, Vargo says. Our painter has painted the entire port side of the ship over the last few years. Now he's moving over to the starboard side. Vargo believes that the best way to view the camouflage paint scheme is from the 10-foot-wide platform that circles the ship. You just can't beat the view, he says. It's just awesome to see the ship dressed up like that. It's also possible to get a close-up look at the North Carolina's camouflage by taking a scenic river cruise along the Cape Fear River. I don't care if you've done the trip 100 times, says Captain Doug Springer, co-owner of the Wilmington Boat Water Tours. You're always humbled when you cruise past her. For that, we can credit those who chose to repaint the ship in Measure 32 in 1995. Given the size of their canvas, it was a master stroke in more ways than one. For more information on Battleship North Carolina, check out their website at battleshipnc.com. And there's a picture here. Today, the Battleship North Carolina wears a modified version of the Measure 32 paint scheme that was chosen for it in 1943, featuring shades of navy blue, deck blue, haze gray, pale gray, and black. And there's a schematic, if you will, of sorts, or a side view and top view, showing the different parts of the ship that are painted the different colors to give it that razzle-dazzle. There's another little side article here. It says, Beyond the Bulkheads. If you're interested in taking a deeper dive into other aspects of the Battleship North Carolina's hidden history, longtime curator Mary Ames Booker has just the tour for you. Hidden Battleship pokes into many of the mysterious areas of the ship not seen on regular tours. Four times a year, guides lead small groups through the ship, top to bottom, from a visit high on the forward superstructure to below decks explorations of places like Engine Room Number 1. It's a lot of bang for your buck, Booker says, an apt expression indeed for a battleship that once lobbed one-ton shells. And one of the picture for early on in the article shows the landing of the battleship. By the time the battleship North Carolina arrived in Wilmington on October 2nd, 1961, escorted by a team of tugboats, it had been repainted a standard haze gray. So it shows a picture of like downtown Wilmington going past the courthouse, if any of you know the courthouse. We'll have a quick article from the House and Home section. Garden tour, garden improv. Every year, one woman invites a theater troupe to perform Shakespeare at her home. When life starts to imitate art, she saves the evening from turning into a farce. In Martha Yarborough's garden in High Point, everything was ready to go. The chairs were all lined up. The larkspur was blooming in the evening June sun. Guests relaxed in lawn chairs, drinking wine and eating caprese salad. There was only one thing left to do, watch a Shakespeare play. But in classic Shakespearean fashion, things don't always or ever really go as planned. A drop of water fell from the sky, and then another. Three thunderclaps later, 80-year-old Yarborough, floral headpiece teetering slightly, yelled, "All right, everyone, inside!" Last year marked Yarborough's sixth hosting a play by Shared Radiance Performing Arts Company, a nonprofit that produces Shakespeare plays, original works, and other projects. The organization was founded by Sherry Rayford, one of Yarborough's best friends. Rayford, a retired theater teacher, started Shared Radiance to bring theater to accessible places, parks, schools, gardens, and other gathering spots. It's a traveling troupe, so the lineup looks a little different each year, but the play in Yarborough's garden is one tradition that doesn't change. Last year, the group performed The Comedy of Errors. The play follows two sets of identical twins who are split up at birth, leading to a series of miscommunications until at last the mystery is solved and everything makes sense. That Night in High Point followed a similar format. Maybe that's why Yarborough never complained about running to rescue Caprese Salad in the rain, or hosting 50 people in her living room, or having a cast of animated characters waltz around on her oriental rug. It was merely a comedy of errors. The day reflected the spirit of the play. First confusion, then laughter, and finally understanding. To learn more, visit the Facebook page, Shared Radiance. And to wrap up our podcast, I'll give you a couple more things that have washed up on shore. In 1976, the Aurora Fossil Museum is founded in Beaufort County, an area that has produced prolific fossil records of marine life in North America, including shark teeth, coral, and whale bones. In 2017, an Outer Banks photographer discovers a piece of a SpaceX rocket's nose cone on the beach near Hatteras Village. And in 2023, several Portuguese man-of-war's balloon-looking creatures with venomous tentacles that can stretch up to 100 feet wash up on the Outer Banks and Oak Island. Well, the music signifies that we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.